Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon with our phone lines open, waiting for your calls if you have questions you'd like to ask about the Bible or about the Christian faith or about your own Christian life or your spiritual journey. If you have a difference of opinion from the host or you even have objections to the whole subject of Christianity and the Bible and you'd like to raise those objections, I'd be glad to talk to you. Especially if you have reasons why you can articulate why you are not a believer in the Bible or in Christianity. And this is your golden opportunity to reach an audience of thousands of Christians and tell them exactly, you know, why they shouldn't be Christians. I'd be glad to hear from you about that. Our lines are open for the most part. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Skip from Carlsbad, California is our first caller. Skip, welcome to the Narrow Path, and thanks for calling. Call screener, I'm hitting the button and it's not activating. There we go, we got you. Skip, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
Yes, hi.
I have a question for you, Steve, about in Hebrews, I think chapter 10, it tells us that animal sacrifices can never take away sin.
Right.
So what I wanted to know is, how do we understand the many Old Testament passages that speak of the offerings and sacrifices that they made then? It made atonement for them. How is that different?
Well, when Hebrews 10 is talking about taking away sin, it's talking about dealing decisively with the issue of sin permanently. The core message of Hebrews 10 is that the sacrificial system, and especially the Day of Atonement that occurred once a year under the sacrificial system, although it atoned for the sins of the people for that year, it was not able to decisively and permanently end the problem of sin for the people. It didn't take that problem away. Instead, it only managed it for another year. And he said if it had finally done away with sin, they wouldn't have to repeat it every year. And so he draws the contrast between that and Christ himself, who offered himself one time, as it says in verse 14, for by one offering he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified. And the idea here is that Jesus' sacrifice finally dealt with the sin problem in a way that the animal sacrifices, blood of bulls and goats, could never do. They never took away sin in the sense of eliminating it as a problem to the believer. Now, we might say, well, Jesus' sacrifice didn't eliminate it either, because we still have to wrestle with sin. We still, even Paul says, we have sin in our members. However, Christ has given, through his sacrifice, a new life through the Spirit, which Paul says, if we walk in the Spirit, it makes us free from the law of sin and death, he says in Romans 8. And that being so, I believe that's what the writer of Hebrews has in mind, that the doing away with sin, that is making us free, entirely free from the problem of sin and death, is an accomplishment of Christ in the new covenant, which was never even attempted in the old covenant. The old covenant, the blood of bulls and goats, didn't really settle anything long term. It didn't take away sin. He's not saying it didn't atone for sin, because the Bible does talk about them making an atonement with the blood of bulls and goats in the Old Testament. But they had to keep doing it over and over again, because none of the atoning sacrifices permanently solved the problem. And that's what I think the writer of Hebrews is getting at throughout chapter 10.
Right on, Steve. I appreciate that. Really clears it up. Thank you very much.
Okay, Skip, thank you for your call. God bless.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Walter from Kaiser, Oregon. Walter, good to hear from you again.
Hello, Steve.
Welcome.
I remembered in reading some of your work, and I'm kind of lazy to look it up again, you mentioned that some of the languages, symbols for the letters, such as the Roman numeral V and X, represent numbers.
Uh-huh.
You had mentioned that the meaning of Nero, Neron.
Kaiser Neron, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Kaiser Neron equaled 666. And I can't remember whether you said that was written then in Hebrew or Greek?
That is written in Hebrew. The Greek letters would be much too large a number. But in Hebrew, the Hebrew characters, it is said that the words Kaiser Nero or Caesar Nero would come out to 666. Now, Walter, one thing that people would automatically think of, well, why would the calculation be done in Hebrew when, in fact, the book of Revelation was written in Greek? Why would they assume a Hebrew calculation? And this raises the question of why is there a gematria even suggested? Why is there a coded name at all? The idea is, I think, that the readers were supposed to be able to calculate it. That's what John said. He that is wise, let him calculate the number of the beast. But he didn't want the average hostile person into whose hands it fell to understand what he was saying. And so he put the name into a numeric value. Now, if he had used either Latin or Greek, anyone might be able to figure it out. But the Christians had some knowledge of Hebrew, which most Romans didn't. And we know that there's even some Hebrew words in the book of Revelation. Though it's written in Greek, it's got some Hebrew words in it, like Abaddon, and it's got Alleluia in there, and it's got Armageddon, and it's got some other Hebrew words. So we know that the Christians who read it, though probably Hebrew was not their first language, they had some familiarity with Hebrew because of the Hebrew scriptures, and therefore it would give reason for him to translate the name of the character he's talking about into Hebrew characters. It would make it much more secretive to all except to the Christians or Jews who might happen to read it.
Well, that makes sense to me.
I think it does.
To me. Thank you very much, Steve.
Okay, Walter. I appreciate your call. God bless you.
All righty. You too. Bye now.
Bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to Tony calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Tony, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. My question is, the Gospel of John, Jesus said, if you believe my word and you believe in him who sent me, you have passed from death unto life.
Right.
Okay. Then there's another scripture, and I forgot where it's in the Bible. It says, to them gave he power to become the sons of God.
Right. Both verses are in John. The first verse you quoted is John 5:24. And the other one is in John 1:12.
Now, does this mean that when a person believes and they repent and they're sorry of their sins, if they're really saved, then that other scripture kind of throws a wrench into it because it says to them gave he power to become the sons of God.
Well, right, because before they believed in him, they were not the children of God. And so when they believed in him, he gave them the power to become the sons of God, and that's exactly what they became. We know this is what he meant because the same writer, John, who said that, also wrote 1 John. And in 1 John 3, verse 2, John says, "Beloved, now we are the children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we should be like him, for we shall see him as he is." So he says, we are now the children of God. This is the same author saying that to Christians. So when he says he gave people who believed in him the power to become sons of God, it suggests that they weren't sons of God previously, and they received the power and the privilege of becoming sons of God through their faith.
Uh-huh. So in other words, as soon as they believed, you know, and were naturally sorry and repented of their sins, Then they were immediately saved. In other words, they didn't have to do anything more to become the sons of God.
That's correct. When you're born again, you're born into God's family. He's begotten us again. That says in 1 Peter chapter 1, it says that God has begotten us again, past tense, into a lively hope. So we have already been begotten again, and we have already been born again. So we are now his children. Now, like it says in the verse I just mentioned, 1 John 3, 2, it says, it does not yet appear what we shall be. He says, we are now children of God, but it has not yet been manifested what we will ultimately be like. He says, when he will appear, we will see him as he is and we'll be like him. So there is an aspect of perfection of our sonship, which has not yet been realized or not yet been seen, but we are already children of God.
Okay, great. Hey, thank you. You answered the question.
Okay, Tony. Thanks for your call. Thank you. Our next caller is Pam from Portland, Oregon, and we do have a line open if you'd like to call. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can reach me at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Pam, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I've been contemplating the differences between American slavery and slavery under the Mosaic Law.
Uh-huh.
And reading Galatians, you know, we looked at Hagar versus Sarah in that respect. My question becomes, in terms of Ishmael, his sons are supposed to be the direct descendants of the Arab people. However, that doesn't seem to include the Moabites and the Ammonites, who were, you know, descendants of Lot by incest.
Right.
So the question is if that's the case, then is that why in Revelations and in other books of the Bible, the implication is that Jews in a later day will find a refuge in Jordan, perhaps Petra, because the people of Jordan are not the sons of Ishmael?
Well, I'm not really sure how those thoughts connect. I don't know of anything in the book of Revelation that says that the Jews will find refuge in Petra. It does speak of the woman fleeing from the face of the dragon into the wilderness. I take that differently than some people do. But it doesn't mention Petra particularly. Now, I know there's an Old Testament passage that mentions something about Bozrah, which I think is the ancient name of Petra. But there really is not, to my knowledge, any passage that speaks about modern Jews fleeing to Petra. Now, I realize it's very commonly taught by popular Bible teachers that the Jews will do that during the tribulation. When they see the Antichrist set up his image in the rebuilt temple in Jerusalem, they'll flee to Petra and be preserved there. That most of that scenario is, to my mind, imaginary. You don't find Bible verses to support it. It's the dispensational scenario. But the Arabs today, we don't know. I don't know if it can be demonstrated for sure where their tribes originated. It is commonly thought, and I think most Arabs believe, that they are descended from Ishmael. But in the Old Testament times, Middle Eastern Bedouins and nomadic peoples, where some of them were Ishmaelites, but others were, as you pointed out, there were Moabites and Ammonites and Edomites that were in the area settled. And these groups, some of them were wiped out by the Babylonians. No doubt there's some intermarriage, as there was in the case of the Moabitess Ruth, marrying a man of the tribe of Judah and being an ancestress of David. The races of the Middle East, I'm sure, got mixed quite a bit, and it'd be very difficult to demonstrate that modern Arabs of any particular country were or were not descended from Ishmael. Again, we assume that the Jews today are descended from Isaac and Jacob, and yet some of that is open to question too, because there are so many different, for example, colors of people who are Jewish. In North Africa, a lot of the Jews look like North African people, dark, you know, black skin, and in Europe, a lot of the Jews look like, you know, white Europeans. And there's even Jews in China that look Chinese. And that suggests very much that they've intermarried a great deal. And so whether we're talking about Jews or Arabs, I don't know that their ancestry is anything that we could demonstrate with certainty, going except maybe in a few cases. And I'm not sure even if there are a few cases where you can. The main thing I would say is, of course, in the Bible, in the New Testament, a person's ancestry is irrelevant. God doesn't like people or dislike people because of who their ancestors were. God is in favor of those who have faith, and that would be true if they're Arab, Jew, or, you know, European or Chinese or whatever. It doesn't matter what your race is. God doesn't evaluate people by race anymore.
I'm sorry. I was going to say he really didn't. Impressed with your scholarship. I have a second quick question, and then I'll get off the air. Okay. And that question concerns what does modern Zionism have to say about or what is the relevance of modern Zionism to Christianity and to our support of a biblical Israelite remnant?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that Zionism has any relevance to New Testament Christianity at all. The Bible indicates in the New Testament, and Jesus himself said this, that the Jews would be scattered as they were in AD 70, said because of their rejection of him, he said, their enemies would cast siege mounts against them, lay their walls down upon them and their children, and not one stone would be left standing on another, that the many of them would be slain by the sword and many others would be carried away into captivity into foreign lands. All of that did happen in 70 AD, and in the New Testament, there's not a single line predicting that a reversal of that situation. There's no place in the New Testament talks about the Jews in the last days coming back to their land. Now, some people think there's hints of it. For example, when Jesus said Jerusalem will be trodden underfoot by the Gentiles until the fullness of the Gentiles is fulfilled, some people think that that means that after the Gentiles have come in, a certain number of them, then the Jews will go back to their land. It doesn't state that. I guess one could read that in there if they want to, but it'd be eisegesis, not exegesis. They're not really finding it stated. And, you know, those kinds of statements are not sufficient to justify Christians taking a political stand, and that's what Zionism is. Zionism is a political movement. It says that the Jews should have a political nation of their own in the Middle East, preferably their ancestral home of Israel, and that Christians should support this. Well, it is certainly on the minds of many Christians to support it, but not with any biblical basis. Now, if they do have biblical basis, or if they think they do, it's all based on certain statements in the Old Testament, which they interpret a certain way, and I think a wrong way. But the Old Testament is not really the authoritative document for Christian conduct. And certainly there's nothing in the Bible, in the New Testament, that says that Christians should be supporting any particular political situation with reference to any nationality, the Jews or any other. So Zionism is entirely a secular movement. And it's in our day, it seems to have gotten impetus as a result of the Holocaust in World War II. Zionism was started before the turn of the 20th century. Before the 20th century, there were, you know, the beginnings of Zionism and Jews moving back to Palestine and so forth and acquiring land. But it was after World War II that a sort of international sentiment seemed to be favorable toward the Jews having their own land so that they might be free from the kind of thing that happened to them in Germany in the wartime. But this is entirely a political thing. We could ask similarly, what would Christianity have to say about taxation levels or something like that? Well, the Bible doesn't specifically talk about taxation levels of secular countries like ours, but we might take a stand based on general Christian principles such as justice. You know, we could say, well, some taxation levels would be unjust; they'd be confiscatory. The government doesn't have the right to take that much from people and provide services that aren't the government's business to provide. A person could take that position as a Christian just because Christians are favorable toward justice, as frankly a lot of non-Christians would be too. Likewise, when it comes to taking a stand for or against the Jews who've gone back to the Promised Land, I think we should support or not support them based on issues of justice, which any good person, and certainly Christians should be good people, anyone who's concerned about justice would have an opinion. A Christian should be especially passionate toward justice. So if we find that in the Middle East, sometimes the Jews are victimized by people who are doing evil things to them, and at other times the Jews are doing the victimizing of people, we should stand always on the side of the victims. And so that might mean that sometimes we stand with Israel and sometimes we stand with their enemies, depending on who's being the bad guy at any given time. And for modern Christians, often they just assume, well, the Jews are always going to be the good guys because they're God's people. That's a fairly naive position in view of the Old Testament. Throughout the Old Testament, the Jews were God's chosen people, but they were the bad guys more often than they were the good guys in the Old Testament. That's why the prophets denounced them. That's why God sent the Assyrians and other nations against them. Read the book of Judges or the books of Kings. or the prophets. You'll find that just because they were God's chosen people, that doesn't mean that God was willing to overlook their injustices and their crimes and their apostasy. So, I mean, I'm not sure why anyone would think God has changed his mind about that now.
Well, except that there seems to be some God-inspired or God-approved genocide of the Canaanites and various groups.
In the Old Testament, yes.
In the Old Testament. So how do you look at that?
Well, I'm not really sure how that relates to Zionism today.
Okay.
Because the Jews who are in Palestine today are under no divine mandate to wipe out the Palestinians, as Joshua was supposed to do to the Canaanites. God gave directions through his prophet Moses about the removal of the Canaanites from the land. And the Jews were, in conquering the land, were following that direct mandate from a prophet. I don't know of any modern prophet in the past few hundred years who has been a true prophet of God, who's risen up and said, thus saith the Lord, Israel, you know, marginalize or wipe out or kill or whatever Palestinians. That would not be something that has any parallel to the biblical mandate of taking the land from the Canaanites.
Agreed. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, I appreciate your call. Very thoughtful. Bye now. Tosha from Portland, Oregon is next. Or Tasha. It's probably Tasha.
Hi.
Hello,
yeah,
welcome.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yes.
I just wanted to respond to your last caller. I listen to you pretty much daily if I can. A couple things. I agree with most of what was just said until we get to the race regarding Jews and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And this is a very deep sentence, so as you hear me say this, I hope no one is alarmed that is listening on the radio, but this is truth, because I'm a daughter of Zion. I'm a daughter of light. I've been awake this year. My father is African-American, but he's not African-American. He's Black American. My mother is Caucasian, which would be Esau. the 12 tribes of Israel are coming out. I'm from the tribe of Judah, and we are awake. We're awakening. That would be the first tribe to awake. And at this point, many people that are not quite sure of what's going on, they think that the Jews over in Israel are the Jews. That's Judaism, which is obviously pagan. And the Caesar Borgia, your call before that, is the mark of the beast. All of that is the white Jesus, and I apologize, but this is the truth. That is the Jesus that everyone seems to worship. But if you look in Revelation 1:14, it says that when John saw the vision of the Son of God, he had white woolly hair and feet and hands that were bronze, eyes a flame of fire as though he was in a furnace. So we know that he was dark, and you were describing different nationalities and so forth, right? But Arabs would definitely not be under this Hebrew Israelite. Those would be the 12 tribes of Israel, obviously.
Tasha, I need to ask you, Tasha, you're talking past me and most of my listeners, so let me just ask you a few questions to clarify.
Yes.
You said that your father was a Black American and your mother was, you said, of Esau?
No, yes.
Okay,
she's
so you said that you were of the tribe of Judah. How is it so that you're of the tribe of Judah if you don't have any Jewish parents?
Because it comes from your father's lineage, and the Jews that are in Israel now are not the Jews. That is the big secret of the word of God. This is the big secret of Yahweh.
Okay, so you're one of those people. You're one of those people who says that the true Jews are Black.
They're Native American. They're Hispanic. They're Dominican. They're Haitian.
Anything but white. I see. So, but Jesus.
It does say in the word. I'm not calling to argue. I'm just trying to clarify a few things for the woman that talked about Petra, because there is an actual place named Petra.
Oh, we know that. Yes, we know that.
But right now, the World War III that everyone is so concerned with will take place, and the United States, including Arabs, that whole area is Babylon the Great. So what you are seeing is actually the last days taking place and being prophesied now. We've come out of captivity, and that's what's happening, is we're coming out of captivity. We've been asleep for over 400 years.
Tasha, hey, I don't want you to just monologue. I want to, because you're talking way, 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 way past most of us. Most of us have no idea what you believe, and so you need to slow down here. Okay, so you're saying that America and the Middle East are the Great Babylon?
Yes.
Okay, and how do you know this is the case?
It's in the Word.
No. Wait. How do you know that when the Word speaks of Great Babylon? I have read about the Great Babylon. How do you know who that's referring to? How do you know it's referring to America, for example?
Well, okay, your two calls a minute ago, there was a gentleman that called in talking about 666 being in Hebrew and so forth. We can see things and we know how to understand the Word of Truth, the living water, the living bread of Christ.
Who's we? The black people?
We Israelites, and I don't want to be referred to as black. I'm a Hebrew Israelite. I'm not a black person.
You're an Afro-Israelite.
I'm not an African. I wasn't sold. Our forefathers were not sold just straight from Africa. The Africans sold us into slavery. You know.
Okay,
so,
but I'm trying to figure out. You're using
the
language.
Reason why I'm called,
excuse me. You're using language. I had to put you on hold because I can't get a word in advance. You're using language that none of us really know. You're using language we know, but using it differently. You're saying that you're of the tribe of Judah, but what you're saying is you're of half black descent. You're through your father's side, who's a black American, and you say he's not Afro-American. Well, I'm not sure. Was he Haitian-American? Somewhere your father's ancestors came from some place where black people are, of course. Now, apparently you're saying that those black people from that place are the tribe of Judah. Now, most people believe that the tribe of Judah are the people who came from the tribe of Judah in the Middle East and would not identify them specifically with any African group or any group other than the Middle Eastern people. Especially those who had descended, if we could find them, from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, I personally, I'll just say this. Your call is not being very helpful, and I would like it to be, because I would like to understand more, the people who think like you do, because I got a call a few years ago from someone who I think thinks the same thing you do. He was a black man, an Israelite or whatever, I don't know what he'd call himself, but he was trying to argue with me that, you know, the true Israelites are black people. And if you don't like the word black, I don't know what word to use. We've had to go through so many different politically correct words for this. But I'm just going to talk about the color of their skin, because that's what he was talking about. He was talking about how the Bible speaks of Jews as being black. And he sent me some scriptures, but the scriptures he sent didn't say that the Jewish people were black. You can say that America is Babylon, the Middle East is Babylon, the black people, part black like yourself, that they are a tribe of Judah. But when I say, how do you know this? You say, we have understanding of these things. In other words, you have sort of an elitist attitude that somebody has told you that you belong to the tribe of Judah, and you apparently like that, and you'll just depend on the fact that whoever told you is one of those we's, who these elite people who understand the scripture without exegesis. Apparently they just read the Bible and their first impression is all that they need. They really don't need to study it. They don't really need to look at things in context. They just understand it because they are the people, you know, who it refers to. Well, this subject is, there's so many presuppositions here that I can't go along with you on, that unless you are able to go back to more fundamental starting point, we can't really have a conversation that's going to be enlightening, because I said you're going to be using words that everybody knows, but you're not meaning the same thing by those words. And you're going to justify your unique use of those words by the fact that you are one of the, you know, select few or the special people who are the we who understand the Bible when everyone else doesn't. But I wouldn't mind having a long conversation with you where we could actually find out why you think these things are true. But I did ask you a moment ago why you think they're true, and you said, well, we understand those things. Well, you know, no one can debate with someone who just says, hey, because I'm me, I'm right. That's not an attitude that really is conducive, a fruitful discussion. If I told you every view I have, it's true because I'm me, and I happen to be one of those people who know these things. of course, we'd just be talking right past each other. I'm afraid that's what we've been doing. And it looks like Tasha didn't like this kind of a confrontation, so she hung up. Let's talk to Daryl from Sacramento, California. Daryl, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you, Steve. I got a question about the covenant, last book to you.
Okay.
About what's the blood significance in the covenants used in the Bible?
What is the significance of the blood? Well, the only significance that's ever stated in Leviticus is where God says the life of the flesh is in the blood. And also that's hinted at in Genesis 9, where it says you cannot eat the animal with the life in it. That is the blood. So apparently blood represents life. Shedding of blood, therefore, represents death. Once the blood is removed from the body is dead. And so either the sacrifices, we could say the blood itself represents life, or the shedding of the animal's blood represents death. And I've heard both things argued. One thing I think that the Bible would support mostly is that the death of a sacrificial victim, or even the death of a testator of a covenant, is what seals the covenant. It says that in Galatians, that a covenant is not in force until the death of the testator, that is the person who's making the covenant. So I'm thinking that the reference to blood of the covenant sealing it, as when Moses had certain animals slain and their blood was put in a basin, and then he tossed the blood on the people and said, "This is the blood of the covenant, which the Lord makes with you today." Or when Jesus, passing around the cup, said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood." Certainly the idea of blood appears to be specifically death, the death of a sacrificial victim. In fact, Jesus' own words were, "This is the blood of the covenant, which is poured out for the remission of sins." So he's obviously referring to his death. So blood, especially the shedding of blood, or blood that is shed, is apparently the removal of life, or death is what it represents. And the death of a victim sealed the inauguration of a covenant. Now, why would it do that? I'm not sure that I could give all the reasons for that. As I said, Paul in Galatians suggests that it's like making a will. The testament that a person makes doesn't go into force until they die. But that's probably more of an illustration that came to Paul's mind rather than the main connection between death and covenants. I suppose that there's a lot of perhaps cultural, Middle Eastern cultural things associated with the blood and covenants, since, for example, Middle Easterners typically, when two people would make a covenant together, they take animals and cut them in two and pass between the two parts. Obviously, there's a death of animals. And the covenant they made was insinuating, if I break this promise I'm making to you, then may I be cut in two like these animals. In other words, may I be killed too. So it seems like the death, the subject of death, which is in the suggestion of slain blood, with a covenant, is basically that the covenanting party says, I'm keeping this covenant on pain of death. You know, may I die if I break the covenant, is kind of the message, I think, associated with it.
Sound like notoriety or notarization.
Like a notary public notarization. Well, it certainly formalizes and makes official the covenant, at least in the ceremonies of the Middle East.
Can I see one more question, please?
Uh-huh.
The imminency of Christ, is it current or is it in the future?
His what?
The imminent return of Christ.
Oh, is it in the future? I believe it's. I believe his coming is in the future. I don't know if it's imminent. The word imminent, when it's associated with the second coming of Christ, usually is meant to mean that his coming could happen at any moment.
Yeah.
When people ask if you believe in the imminent second coming, they mean, do you think it could happen at any moment? I suppose it could happen at any moment, but I don't know if it can or not. There might be some more things that Jesus is hoping to accomplish. After all, he's been working on something for 2,000 years, and that has prevented him from coming previous to this. If he's still working on that project, he might well wait until he's finished with it and then come. So it may be that it would be unrealistic to say Jesus could come at any moment, since he hasn't done all the things that he might be wanting to do, if that's the case. Now, does the Bible teach the imminent second coming of Christ? No, it doesn't. Actually, Paul said in 2 Corinthians 2 that no one should be led astray by anyone who teaches such a thing. He said, he said that time cannot come, that coming of the Lord cannot take place until there be a great falling away and the man of sin be revealed and so forth, he said. In other words, Paul was saying the second coming of Christ can't come at any moment because there's some things that have to happen first. And so Paul didn't teach the imminent second coming of Christ in any of his passages, and Jesus certainly didn't, because Jesus made it very clear before he left that his disciples would be witnesses in all the world. So let's say a week or two or 10 after Jesus left, or a year after he left, none of the disciples could imagine that Jesus would be coming back imminently, because he'd already said, no, you're going to go to all the world and be a witness and so forth. Mm-hmm. And he'd even predicted that Peter would die a certain way. And as long as Peter had not died, then obviously they couldn't expect Jesus to come back. So there's no time during the life of the apostles that the imminent second coming of Christ was taught, as near as we can tell. Not by the apostles, anyway.
Well, thank you. That's rock bottom for me.
All right, Daryl. God bless you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. Okay, Elizabeth from Sacramento, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
My question is about Christmas, and I would like to know if you can discuss biblical basis for Christmas or lack of, and if there is any danger in celebrating Christmas as a Christian. And I can listen off there.
Okay, Elizabeth, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
All right. Well, first of all, there is no biblical basis for the celebration of Christmas. Obviously, if in celebrating Christmas, if we're celebrating the birth of Jesus, there is a biblical basis for his birth, the event itself. There is even certainly a biblical basis for our rejoicing that he was born because of what he came to accomplish. Even the angels rejoiced and sang celebration at the occasion of his birth. But in terms of an annual celebration of his birth, there's certainly no evidence that this was ever done in the early church. Jesus and the apostles never said that people should do it. In fact, they never even preserved for the church a knowledge of what day Jesus was born. Nobody knows when Jesus was born because the apostles didn't preserve any information about that. They didn't celebrate it. So obviously there's no biblical basis for an annual celebration of Christmas. Now, does that mean it's a bad thing to celebrate Christmas? I wouldn't say so. I mean, why would it be bad to celebrate something good? We celebrate the birth of our own children. Now, some people, like Jehovah's Witnesses, say we shouldn't even do that. I can't imagine why anyone would object to celebrating your child's birth, but I guess maybe because if you do allow it, then that argues for the legitimacy of celebrating Jesus' birth, and Jehovah's Witnesses are against that too. But I think people can celebrate Christmas or not and be equally, pleasing to God. It's what's in your heart, really. Now, a person can celebrate Christmas and not be pleasing to God if they're not, you know, mindful of God. There's lots of people who celebrate Christmas as a secular holiday where they go out and they get drunk and they do the same kind of evil things they do other holidays. Certainly, celebrating Christmas on that occasion is a bad thing, I mean, for that purpose. But if people celebrate Christmas as an occasion to worship Christ, to thank God and so forth, I don't really see how that could be objectionable to anybody, except maybe very legalistic people. Now, some people point out that December 25th, of course, was not necessarily the day that Jesus was born. And yet it was, at one time in the Roman Empire, a very pagan celebration itself. And some of the customs that have come into our traditional ways of celebrating Christmas come from pagan origins, if you go back far enough. The question is, do we need to go back far enough? Why don't we just go back to the moment we're doing it? Because if the pagans used to do certain things, let's say they used to bring trees into the house and decorate them at, you know, to celebrate the winter solstice. Well, that was a pagan thing to do. And so if someone would argue, well, therefore, since they did that, we shouldn't bring trees into the house. Well, what if we found out that certain pagans lit candles in their house on certain days. Does that mean we should never have lights in our house? We should never have lamps or candles in our house because the pagans used to illuminate their lights, their house on pagan festivals too? I don't really see it. I don't really see how what pagans did that had a certain meaning to them would have an impact on us doing similar harmless things if it has no such meaning to us. Lots of people have house plants in their house and they don't think a thing of it as a heathen or Christian thing. They just like house plants. Lots of people like to have a tree in their house, a Christmas tree at this season. I know a lady in Santa Cruz who keeps her Christmas tree up all year round. Every no matter what time of the year I go to her house, her tree is up and decorated in her living room. Is this wrong? Is this bad? I don't see what I don't see how any biblical case could be made against it. It's I think people get a little too uptight when they first realize maybe that some of the things done at Christmas time were done by pagans before they were done by Christians. And yet they don't realize that they were done for a different reason by the pagans than the reason that Christians do them. And I think the reason you're doing it is what determines whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that you're doing. That would be my my evaluation of it. Tiffany from Las Vegas, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Mr. Greg. I was calling to comment on the Zionism. I'm trying to put this in a very nice way because I grew up that way. It's very foolish, actually. I don't want to offend anyone, but I would have to say for what it is very dumb. The way that the thought process is that black people, and I'm black, that they are the tribe of Judah in some way. I have a father who is from Barbados. And there are a lot of cultures that are darker skinned, but it's supposed to be a movement. If you ever read anything about Malcolm X, about at first this was what he believed, but then later found out that this is just an American, or not even Americanized. It was something that came up, was circular and supposed to be spiritual. People came together and decided they wanted to put Zionism together. I guess that's what they call it. I grew up that way.
Well, Zionism is something different than what that lady was talking about, because Zionism technically simply is the support for the migration of Jews from all over the world into the Middle East to become part of an Israeli state. And but some people combine that with different strange views, like that lady's view apparently was that the Jewish people were black-skinned, and that that modern black-skinned people like her father are therefore descended from the tribe of Judah. But that's not technically what Zionism is, but it's apparently they mix that together.
Well, it's a view that the viewpoint that they had because they believe that, of course, black people is the ultimate race. Just from my own background and my own experience with having to deal with that, that's what they call it. I know in some books and in some places it will say differently, of course, but if you ever get a chance to talk with someone who actually grew up that way, you will see the viewpoint as hers is definitely different, because her viewpoint was the same way actually I grew up, but it's not. I come to find out is different only because of the word of God. I am very proud of who I am. I'm very proud of being black. But also, I believe in God created us all regardless of who you are, really, because that's what he says. But my viewpoint on that is very foolish. BS, rather. I would have to use that. I don't want to use the term, but that's what it really is. From her standpoint, I'm not saying...
I don't really understand the mentality of anyone who's proud of their race. Since if I'm going to be proud, it'll be of something I have done or accomplished. I would think my race was something I had nothing to do with it, and my parents had nothing to do with it, and their parents had nothing to do with it. Our race goes back to things that happened way back after the flood, and which none of us had anything to do with making happen, and therefore my being white. I could never even imagine saying I'm proud to be white, since I didn't make myself white. And if and I don't really know that there's anything better about being white. I don't think there is. There are some advantages in some parts of the world to being white, and in some parts of the world there's probably advantages to being black or some other color. But the point is that skin is only skin. Now, what sometimes goes along with skin colors are cultural things. Obviously, a lot of white Americans have European culture behind them. A lot of black people have slave culture, if they happen to have been descended from slaves. Of course, they don't have slave culture now, but they've got that in their background. Others who never were slaves, they've got, you know, some African cultures behind them. Well, cultures can be good or bad. I'm not particularly proud of any particular cultural aspect. I'm glad that I was raised a Christian. That's a good thing, I think, to be raised a Christian. But it's, to me, anyone can be a Christian. Black, white, yellow, red, doesn't matter what color their skin is, anyone can be a Christian. And it's not something we're proud of. That's something that we're thankful for. As far as, you know, being proud to have German background or English background or whatever, Irish background, whatever I've got, it would never, never occur to me to be proud of any of those things. So I think, what did I have to do with any of that? Nothing. I don't think pride of race is a healthy thing. I think pride of race is racism, really. I think we should be unconcerned about race and concerned about, as one very famous black man said, who, and most big cities have main streets named after him, I think people should be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. And that's just common sense. And to my mind, when someone is saying I'm loyal to, or I'm proud of, or whatever, this group of people that I belong to who have the same skin color I have, I think, why? Well, I'm not proud to be white. There's a lot of white people that stink. A lot of white people that are very evil. I'm not proud of that. I think that a person who is a follower of Christ is a commendable person, whether they're black or white or yellow or whatever color. And otherwise, race is absolutely not something even to be taken into consideration in my thinking. Now, you might say that's easy for you because you're a white male, and white males have had, you know, political dominance in the West for so long and so forth, and we're not part of an oppressed people. Well, there are truths in that, but I don't live at a time where that oppression has been institutionalized. Actually, as a matter of fact, I live at a time where the government is making laws to try to prevent that as much as possible. But I do choose to be part of a Christian movement, which is, and historically has always been, an oppressed and persecuted group of people. And that's something I did by choice. I didn't choose my skin color, but I did choose to stand for Christ. And that is something that is a movement that had its roots in oppression and persecution. That is, Christians were persecuted and were oppressed throughout the world and have been still. So it's not really skin color. It's your convictions. It's your quality of your character that you should even think about, in my opinion. Of course, if a person's raised in an English home or a Chinese home or a Japanese home let's say an American black family or whatever, there will probably, in most cases, be some cultural distinctives that are part of our upbringing, and we may like those. We may feel good about those cultural distinctives, but presumably a person of any race could choose those cultural distinctives. That's some cultures are good and some are bad, but there's not a skin color that's good and a skin color that's bad. That's just skin colors, to my mind. I can't even imagine anything less relevant to anything but that. In terms of evaluating a person, I realize, of course, I've got a lot of minority people probably listening who say, well, Steve, if you were a minority, you'd know what a difference it makes. I do know. I mean, I don't know it as well as some who are in the minorities, but I know there are places and societies and institutions where your skin color probably does keep you from having certain privileges that you would have if you had a different skin color. I understand that. And there are areas where I will be less respected because I'm a Christian than other places, like at a university or someplace like that. But I think more and more we need to stop thinking that our race is what's important. And I think the lady you're responding to, Tiffany, she felt like her race was very important. She felt like she was one of the chosen people. And my message to anyone who thinks that is, you're not one of the chosen people because of who your ancestors are. If you're one of the chosen people, it's because you've made a personal decision to be a disciple of Jesus. And frankly, to anything that was gained to you before, you've renounced that and counted as dung. Like Paul said, he had something to boast in, but he said he gave that up in order that he might just be associated with Christ. And that's what we all need to do. And not the whole race issue is just such a satanically charged, divisive thing in society, in the church and outside of the church. I think we need to just give up on thinking about race as much as possible. I realize that it's thrust in our face all the time by the media, but it's still something that's not, in God's sight, significant. It's what's in the heart. It's the character. I appreciate that, Tiffany. I'm almost out of time, but Chris wrote to me from Canada. He said, do you believe that all the unbelievers hate God? Romans 5:10, he says, tells us we were enemies of God. But when I was an unbeliever, I didn't hate him. I didn't know him. So how could I hate him? Calvinists, however, claim that every unbeliever does, in fact, hate God. How would you interpret Romans 5:10? Asked Chris. Well, Romans 5:10 said, if when we were enemies of God, he sent his son, how much more, now that we've been reconciled, will he not give us all things? Or will be saved by his life and so forth? He says, we were enemies of God. That doesn't mean we hated God. Being an enemy means that you are on the opposite side. Now, like in World War II, American soldiers were on the opposite side from German soldiers. That didn't mean they hated them, but it meant they were resisting them. It meant that they were seeking to thwart their agenda. The Germans wanted to control, you know, an area, and the Americans and British didn't want them to. So we were enemies. We were on different sides of a struggle. That doesn't really mean we hated them or that they hated us necessarily. Some of the soldiers probably didn't have any thoughts emotionally about us at all. They just knew that they're under orders and they're shooting. So being an enemy doesn't necessarily mean hating. It can. But when Paul says we were enemies of God, he doesn't say specifically we hated God, and certainly not everyone hates God. Not every non-Christian hates God. Most people probably don't hate God. But anyone who's not in the kingdom of God is on the other side in the kingdom that is resisting the kingdom of God. And therefore, we're part of the enemy ranks until we are on God's side. Jesus said, if you're not for me, you're against me, okay? So Christ has an agenda, and he wants all of us to be participating in it. It's his kingdom. Anyone who's not in his kingdom is resisting that agenda, whether they know it or not. And that's because his agenda is he wants their total surrender. He wants their total allegiance. He wants their total obedience to him. He's the king. And anyone who's withholding that from him is resisting him, is an enemy. They're on the other side from him. So Paul says we were enemies of God at one time. He doesn't say we necessarily hated God. And if someone goes so far as to say because we were enemies, we hated God, they're reading into Paul, I think, something that he didn't necessarily justify us reading into his words. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website if you'd like. It's thenarrowpath.com. Lots of free resources, nothing for sale at the website. You can take everything that's there for free. However, you can donate there also, and that's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you. Thank you.